The views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
Like sometimes it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the time.
All right, folks, we're back here with Punkonomics here on WPRK. We're in Park, Florida, the voice of Rollins College and the best in basement radio. Anyway, we were laughing here quite a bit when we decided to play the top of the hour stuff. And Dr. Balak, I think you have a couple of things for us to line up on your computer.
Absolutely. And first of all, I have to say with all sincerity and gravitas, Rick gravitas. Scott, baby! I'm, of course, kind of referring in a cleaned up version to the, you know, the sketches and the Chappelle show. Anybody a fan out there, you know, but I can't use the other B word. And
I know, yeah. Well,
and it's all the same, Rick.
Yeah, you know, hopefully it won't be taking away food stamps or making people take drug tests before they get their food stamps.
Yeah.
You know, he was really big on that. Of course, he actually owned the laboratories.
Right.
Yeah. Conflict of interest.
And again, a bit like the ID, you know, the voter fraud, right? That there was the numbers again, you know, how many welfare recipients tested when the tests were indeed done. Were a tiny fraction.
Right.
Tiny fraction.
Right. Yeah, he made out like
that
a
had any kind of remnant of any illicit drug in their body, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure he recycled that money into his campaign funds.
Yeah, you know, that, yeah, surely with some creative accounting, you know, but hey, you know. So yeah, there's plenty of that. Once again, let alone the ethical notion of, you know, where you have, if you're poor, you're supposed to be the perfect and responsible despite all the difficulties that it is, you know, and we all, at least normal people out there, you know, we all, oh, I wish I'd spend that weekend, I did this, but instead you just kind of veg out in front of the telly and stuff. So we know it's hard to always be perfect.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
I mean, you know, so when, and the pressure is up, it's even harder, right? So imagine, I mean, do we have any empathy? Adam Smith said that that's the thing that will keep a market system functioning is a societal empathy. I mean, do you think, I mean, when you're working for minimum wage jobs and your kids are in a failing school and you don't have healthcare coverage, I mean, you can really always make the right responsible choice, you know? Not easy. But of course, if you're a wealthy banker, for example, oh, then you can totally screw up. You can smoke up $1 billion, lose it on the way, federal crimes. It's all good, master.
Yeah, because you can write it up on taxes,
fine,
too.
Don't worry. No problem. As some people say, you know, it's socialism for the rich and capitalism for the rest of us. You know?
Yep. Yeah, that's good. I like that.
Yeah. Think about it, right? I mean, oh, yeah. It's one of the things that I like about libertarians, in fact, is that they do pay attention to the fact that the way the government is set up today is to protect, you know, large, powerful interests from competition, from the public, and literally from the law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, and the financial sectors suck, you know, like some $6 trillion of our tax money for having screwed up themselves. That's socialists never did. Soviets never came close to such massive centralized support. I mean, that's effectively our entire financial system was nationalized. I mean, Stalin wouldn't be able to pull something like that off. But we did. So again, this double talk, you know, and then we talk about, oh, socialism, oh, do you stand for the market or you stand for, I'm like, sit down, you know, don't stand. That's not the issue here. And all the better for having, you know, good discussions with libertarians and such. But yes, I did prepare a little thing. So first of all, there's a lot of stuff I don't know, you know, I mean, all these internal politics, I don't even know a lot. Again, I don't have the votes, so I don't really have to, right? I'm sorry to scare you. Maybe in a year or two, I might have it, you know? And then I pledge right now on the air to never vote for anybody associated, even if I like them and I think they're great. I mean, it's just like, first become independent, then we talk. But there's something like not seeing the forest for all the trees, right? It's an old expression. So sometimes I think, you know, I personally could definitely be accused of being a generalist, but by nature of my interests, perhaps. So do I know all the ins and outs of the healthcare system before I, you know, criticize it, publicly? Maybe not, you know, surely not, in fact, right? But I do think that sometimes the discourse of expertise, you know, or the professional, you know, comes along and hits you with all those little details, obscures the big picture. And one of the goals, I think, in our show is that we do look at the big picture. So if we're talking about Florida politics, what do I know about Florida politics? Not much. You know, you were fighting with Adrian Wiley there. But I was like, I don't know what they're talking about. I know. But again, I do think
I'm sure he wasn't expecting me.
No, but I think, you know, I mean, I think I, the way I see it, and, you know, that's the only way, you know, what can I say, right? I mean, it was an opportunity to, you know, for him to show, and I think successfully, that, you know, having a good argument, another kind of here's a platform for you. I find it actually NPR. So here, hate alert, you know, I hate on NPR. I know what Fox Network is doing. I know what MSNBC Network is doing, you know. NPR is supposed to be public. Of course, a lot of it now is funded by private. Right. Okay, mm-hmm.
Koch brothers, all those guys.
They don't have a direct, though. You know, this indirect is all it is. Later tonight, I have my propaganda class, and we discuss how you don't have to have a censor to censor. Just, you know, the right incentive set in place. But still, I'm always highly disappointed with NPR because they generally, you know, we make jokes about the NPR public, you know, relatively well-educated, relatively even liberal, let's say, you know, all of that stuff. And you'd think they would be able to talk about stuff. But no, they're just like Fox with longer words and less outright hood-wearing Klansmanship, frankly. I mean, I'm being, you know, because it was supposed to be unflow entertaining, and if I stop laughing, I start crying. But yeah, you see, I mean, you'd think that why don't they talk about some alternative economic models, some real left ideas, you know? They stay with the same spectrum of, you know, wishy-washy and outright cuckoo, you know? They don't really expose the listenership to the breadth of information, opinions, divergent ideologies, etc., that those people would probably be happy to receive.
Mm-hmm.
So they, in that sense, you know, they are, again, an effective evil, you know? And when I heard them talk with candidates, they're so polite, and I mean, never mind politeness. I was being polite, too. I was actually almost, like, holding you back a little bit. but let's talk about the real issues. And again, and I've heard NPR discussions and they're so, no, they never push for the real issues. And you could do that with respect and, you know.
People are afraid of talking about the real issues is what it is. And that's what I find, because even in my circle, when I bring up the issues, people run away. I mean, they really don't want to discuss it. We don't want to talk about that. So, well, when do we talk about it?
You'd think it would be interesting because our future depends on it. But, so I'm defending myself in some sense that I do think that often the details obscure the big picture. And maybe I think it's important to do that when it comes to, like we try and do in the show, when it comes to foreign policy, economics, race, you know, I mean, not the specific every time, but again, the forest, not necessarily the trees. That's also particularly important because, it kind of lends attention. So often the argument then gets into the minutia, right? Into the details. Oh, but that. Oh, you're sure it's 3.5%? Oh no, maybe it's 4. And what? Let's not talk about maybe specific legislation. Let's talk about the general legislative agenda, right? So the context comes to mind, you know, and the context really of you know, like we talk about the electoral fraud. What's going on in the racial relationship in America in general in the past decades? The bigger picture and the context in which these things have to be understood. Otherwise, you can't understand them. So it's an economics metaphor, really. You have to kind of find the balance between being what we call a dilettante, you know, somebody who knows a little bit about everything, but nothing in depth.
In particular, right.
Or, and the opposite is what traditionally, I don't know if it's a politically correct term, but that's the old term, idiot savant. You know, somebody who has like severe disabilities, but has some amazing talent.
Right.
You know, So, you know, people who are severely, disabled, but can do massive calculations in their heads, you know, that's what known as the idiot savant. And so it's important to do a specialization in trade, as the economists have been talking about for centuries, literally, right? And not focus constantly only on your specific expertise. And if you don't know the big picture, or at least are in conversation with people who see the big picture, well, you know, you get a partial picture that can easily be manipulated too. That's another thing. And in fact, that is one of the reasons why we have general education curriculum in schools. And this is kind of one of the major argument, if not the core argument, in my view, behind the liberal arts, right? This notion of having a general idea of multiple disciplines. Then you can figure out your specific profession in graduate school or on the job or by yourself. But you can't really, it's very difficult, or you're old by the time you get there by yourself, if at all, to pick it up, and hence I'm a big advocate of liberal arts as certainly a beginning of an education. And it's useful, even for practical purposes. It's not this notion of, there's no need to know any philosophy if you're going to be an engineer. I disagree.
Right, I disagree, you know? Too.
Mm-hmm. So there. That was my little piece on not seeing the forest for all the trees, you know, and an apology and a defense of myself in some sense when I don't necessarily know the details and yet, opinionated nonetheless. At least I admit it, you know.
Now, when we were off the air, you was looking into the internet about the statistics of how many people came out, and you're saying they counted was 40%.
Yeah. I haven't actually. I didn't find. I kind of gave up on it a little bit. I didn't find any kind of final number for Florida. I mean, usually you kind of the ballpark figure I know is kind of expected to be about 50%, which is of course very low. I wonder if more or less how it was. Maybe we'll wait. I don't know. Somebody tell me. I'm sure that you know.
You know, I think we're. I think Adrian would have gotten a lot more votes if had he started a little bit earlier. I got a text last night from my former roommate. Shout out to Chris Cocopelli out there. Sends me a text because he heard the program that we had last week. And he says, so what is Adrian's platform? And, at that point, I wasn't going to get into a major text detail and all that. I just joked and I just text back. I said, well, he's probably going to try to pray that he gets some of the votes. But, yes. You know, again, my roommate, I think he's a libertarian because we've had, conversations just like you and I have on the air. And he didn't know anything about Adrian.
That's true, by the way. It's true all over the place. There is a. God, I'm trying to, my aging, calcified brain, but it was a shocking statistics at least a few years back that a tremendous, first of all, it's like 96 or 97% of Americans vote for either of the big parties. So it's the fact that he got 3.75 is probably relatively high.
Yeah, it's really good.
And there are the two candidates, independent, so even harder for them,
Right. And again, I didn't even know who they were.
But that's right. So the numbers are that a majority of Americans, I don't remember if it's 60% or 70, I don't know, but a shockingly large, don't even know that there are other parties. Don't even know that they exist. You know, when asked, right, do you know if there's such a thing as a libertarian party? You know, there's other parties than the Democrat or the Republicans? No. Now, of course, again, the debates, the mainstream media, that horse race you were describing earlier, it's all about Republicans and Democrats. And if anybody talks about third party, well, often they talk about how, you're a spoiler, right? Just like
right,
I raise,
right.
But again, I raise it facetiously in the sense that there might be people out there thinking that, Wiley took votes probably away from Chris. That's why Scott won. So what? It's like people said about Bush in 2000. Mm-hmm. Well, really, Bush won because they cheated. But some people said that, and wait, if Gore would have won, would we, a lot of people say we wouldn't be in Iraq. Really? Really? So, not that Bush was anything but a horrible president, but I don't know if Gore would have been much better.
Then again, we may have free internet.
Yeah. No, I don't know about that either, Yeah, maybe. But seriously, right? So Gnader, who runs often, on the left, for the Green Party at the time. So
right.
That's what... But really, I mean, there must be, well, I'll say it again. I say it all the time. I know I'm a broken record. Maybe what we need is, you know, the Green Party, which is kind of the socialists, if you will, though they're focusing on environment, but poverty and such, you right. know, in America, socialism is still hangover from the Cold War, dirty word. It, in many ways, American socialists made America great back in the pre-Soviet days, you know.
Right, right, right.
So I, you know, there shouldn't be a dirty word. Stalinism should be a dirty word. The Soviet Union should be a dirty word. I'm fine with that. But no, anyway. So the left, the real left, the non-corporatist left, and the real right, you know, libertarians should get together, because together they might have a sufficient mass to break through. But again, I mean, since Ross Perot was a kind of a libertarian-ish independent candidate and got into the debates, they plugged that hole. So nobody, you know, you don't get exposure except for an alternative media. So in the presidential election of 2012, there was, like, you know, on Democracy Now! Held, which is a very big kind of liberal alternative media, held a debate in which you had the libertarian and the green and a couple of others getting a chance to say what they have to say. And there's some evidence that actually, again, Americans are more, are open to those ideas when they are allowed to discuss the real issues, then their ideas are in line with those parties, not the Republicans or the Democrats.
Right, right.
Certainly not their actions. Again, you know, the Democrats talk the talk, especially Obama has clearly been, and Clinton also, I mean, let's give him credit in double quotation marks, you know, for being able to talk the talk and then screw us over.
Right, right, right.
Despite the beautiful words. So there you have it. But you know what? That's, funnily enough, that kind of segues into my last prepared note. I think this is going to, show is going to go in history as the one that I might have actually gone through my notes.
You know, you might be right.
And it's about economic education. Now, the segue is the fact that socialist is a dirty word in America. You know, that's kind of where it fits the picture. And I kind of got to thinking about sharing this stuff, having listened to one of my favorite podcasts by Rick Wolf, who does a lot of public, now that he's emeritus, you know, he has more time on his hands and doesn't have to publish, you know, write books and publish papers, and he's a public intellectual, and he's quite, he's one of the people that inspired me in some ways to reach to both sides, you know, to right and left, that this is really not an ideological question, this is a common sense question. But he kind of in a recent podcast talked about this, and I thought I'd share some of this stuff that I'm familiar with, of course, being an economist and being a historian of economics. So what about this field, economics? A lot of people studied it a little bit. Most people hate it, and frankly, for a good reason, because, you know, if it had to be what you learn in that thick book called economics, no doubt, I mean, at best, it doesn't fit your real world experience, that's for sure. And, you know, the field has been sick for a long time, certainly in terms of, let's not talk even about the research, but about the teaching of it, which is perhaps, I like to call it pop economics, popular economics, right? Most people, judges, politicians, lawyers, influential people, are not PhDs in economics. They took a few economic courses, yeah? So, and they are the influential people. So the education teaching economics is very important at the undergraduate level. Now, there have been literally uprisings around the world, you know, and some of which I was somewhat, I mean, uprising, right? As graduate student uprising. It's not exactly took over the campus with AK-47s, you know, but, you know, signed petitions, you know, whatever. In Europe, even in America, calling for reforming economics to fit, certainly the education at least, to fit more with more current debates in economics and not present it as this kind of a one-sided, simplistic story where once you spend 8 years studying it, you realize, wait a minute, that's what in the textbook is. Well, like I tell my students whenever I open an entry class, I say, like, you know that big fat book, Economics, that I have not asked you to buy for $250? The reason why I haven't asked you to buy it is because it's 80% BS. And I'm not ideologically, either by presenting a position without presenting counterproof that we have or counter evidence, or presenting positions not as ongoing argument, but as somehow resolved fact, presenting things that are neat models but are completely refuted scientifically with statistics for a long time as facts, or just mathematically wrong, by the way. It's shocking. So, having said that, we argue about it, we have conferences about education and reform and blah, blah, blah of economics, and then everybody goes back and does the same thing.
Right, right.
Few places try not to. Very few. We are one of them. I'm kind of, that's why I came here to Rollins, by the way. I was hired for this purpose, to help reform. And ever since, I've been even advising other schools on how to do their own reforms. It's a shockingly small group of schools that teach it differently, but it's growing, so there's something about that. But what is lacking in most cases, and for general public or people who weren't fortunate enough to take, like in Rollins, economics education, is the understanding the economy and why it's not working. And they tell you how it's supposed to work, right? Yet you can't get a job, or you don't get the job that you want, or, you know, things are not working the way that they tell you in the textbook, are they? And one of the problems is that before the Cold War, economics, whether it were all over the world, including America, was multidisciplinary, was broad political economics. Right? So there were these arguments going on in the field. There were multiple perspectives presented and presented as the arguments, and often unresolved, that they are. Then the Cold War happened. And the Cold War was, you know, it's, man, that Cold War is awful. I mean, it damaged, you know, you think, oh, America won, right? Freedom won, Russians lost. I mean, right. In some sense they have. But that was really bad for everybody. That was a really bad, bad thing for everybody. And one of the and first of all, it moved. I mean, you know, we've talked about it. It moved America into a path of imperialism. And again, shout out to our libertarian friends who know that. And that has been dramatically bad for everybody. You know, except for the cannon merchants. So. But that if there was a win, it was very costly, very, very costly. And part of it also was this, like, propaganda that came into politically loaded fields such as economics. So there's no pros and cons of either capitalism or socialism. It seems like an obvious way to teach, right? I mean, if we have two major schools of how to organize an economy, and of course, it's complicated, but everything has a cost and a benefit. We say that in one sentence in the textbook, and then we say, and capitalism good, socialism bad. Wait a minute. Both of them have pros and cons. Is there a way of combining? In fact, American capitalism worked at its best when it, as obvious to anybody should be, when it was a hybrid. So when we were, government was not paying our tax money to private bankers, but was investing in science, for example.
Right.
Right? Is that socialism? I don't know. Call it what you will. It's rational. But they have cost and benefit. Capitalism always creates unemployment. That's a chronic disease of capitalism. A capitalist or pro-market person will say, well, yeah, but its advantages are overwhelming, so we can deal with the unemployment by providing retraining, by providing unemployment benefits, and even if we have to carry a small section of the population, subsidize them because they can't find a job, it's still worth it, and we have so much other wealth generated that if we don't give it to bankers to spend on cocaine and prostitutes, we can cover everybody, no problem.
Right, right, right.
I had to slip that in.
And there is proof of that too.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of channeling a rational argument for pro-market argument. But to say, no, it's perfect. Don't touch it. That's religion. That's not social science.
That
belongs not in academia. It belongs in the church or temple or whatever, right? So no pros and cons explained about economic system. There's one good and one evil. Ridiculous. I mean, even in theology, they have doubt, you know?
Right.
In some sense, even right-wing free market thinkers before this Cold War uniformity was imposed would think like that. We're weighing the costs and benefits and arguing kind of along the lines I'm suggesting that, yeah, the market system is better. Or this is a way we can make the market system better and we can avoid the pitfalls, or etc. If you don't see what you're doing, then you really, you're destined to some kind of catastrophe. And even think, every system will have problems. Like, in the case of capitalism, one of the main things are its busts and booms and busts, right? Recessions, depressions, different collapses as we've experienced relatively recently, and we'll probably experience soon enough again. Now, if we don't criticize something, how can we fix it to make it better?
Correct.
I mean, so you have to, like, what are the weaknesses of something? That's how engineers work. But if you start criticizing capitalism, you mean you're not adherent to the true faith? Burn him!
Right, and the one thing about propaganda that they spew is, right away you're anti-American.
Right.
That's the first thing that comes out of their mouths. And it's like, no. Mm-hmm. On the contrary, you're really an American if you criticize the system because you want to make it better.
Right. Or so it should be. But, yeah, you know. And again, I mean, it's not an American disease. Every place, you know, when I lived in Europe, I used to annoy people there too. Don't worry about it, you know. And like, yeah. So there's plenty of that. But it is a very dangerous place to be culturally. I mean, you get conservative, conservative could be a good thing, right? Let's say conserve the environment, you know? I mean, it's not like necessarily be careful not to rush head on into some new fashionable idea that might be disastrous, you know? I mean, in that sense. However, you have to maintain a certain degree of flexibility. That's a given, right? I mean, if you're not flexible, the environment changes. Not just I'm talking broadly environment, not just the climate, just like the economy. The demographics, things change, and we have to be able to adapt. So if we're not observing the weaknesses, again, criticizing, and this is a term that we use, you know, like critical thinking, terms that we use in academia, we use in teaching, and some people will say, oh, you shouldn't be overcritical. I'm like, no, the danger is being undercritical. You need to criticize all the time. Otherwise, you know, it becomes this kind of cheerleading, which has its place, but
right, it's the mob football mentality.
Yeah. And we've had these situations, whether it's insecurity, whether it's about the American Constitution being eroded, whether it is, terrorism threats, banking fraud and financial catastrophes, all of those problems that we had, there were people who were yelling. And often they were stifled by this just spirit of, oh, be a team player, don't be such a downer, why are you always criticizing stuff, just, you know, rah, rah. Again, you know, I'm not saying that you cheer for your team in a sport event, enjoy yourself, that's what they're for, you know, but when it comes to your economy and a political system, no, not a good idea. It's dangerous in the long run, in other words. And then there's also, of course, this aspect that along with this, it's kind of apologia, to use actually the term from religious studies, you know, where you excuse something, right? You defend it. Yeah. Just like I was doing about the fact that I don't know much about local politics. So I'm kind of giving excuses. Yeah. For the status quo, you know, this is the situation we have and we don't want to, you know, touch it. Well, that's kind of, again, historically scary, in the sense that it is a sign of decline, not of strength. You think that, no, this is somehow stabilizing. But again, you're assuming that the world doesn't change around you.
Right.
And then you're saying like, hey, it was good enough for my grandfather, it's good enough for me. No, wrong. You know, it was good enough for your grandfather, and it's probably a good evidence that it's not good enough for you now, because the world has changed in some sense. So defending the status quo is dangerous in that it stifles, you know, radical ideas from, you know, a diversity. This is kind of the biological, literally, argument for diversity. You need a diversity of ideas that are allowed to express themselves and are even encouraged to engage in a productive argument all the time, because knowledge comes out of argument. That's how you produce it, you know? So if you are just re-bolstering a set of ideas that's established, the majority view, a smart system will actually try and encourage, literally on purpose, a kind of affirmative action, if you will, of ideas. Let's go to the margins and look see what they have to say. Because it's, if there's a strong majority view, it tends to stifle these ideas. And there's a good chance that the idea that'll save the day is over there. It's coming, you know, something that seems crazy. And again, you look at history, you find that all these amazing ideas that today we celebrate as, you know, wonderful, like free market, you know, they were radical in the beginning. Right. They were considered impossible, you know? So there you are again. We have to kind of act actively encourage questioning things, coming up with innovative ideas, even as weird as they are. And that goes back to even what you said about Berkeley shunning Bill Maher, despite the fact that he's a douche. You know, they should have let him talk because, you know, it's let it out. Let's talk about it.
Right.
And I really try and do it in my class. And I think I'll admit that I don't want to toot my horn or something, but in some sense, you know, I mean, I have my very strong opinions and some of them very weird, if you will, very out of the mainstream. But I have a wonderful relationship with a lot of my students, such as the students that came here to the show twice, you know, that are because I encourage discussion. And a student that says things that are completely against my views, I extra encourage them. You know, I go out of my way to encourage them because I find that that is exactly what I want happening, to foster productive argument and also to make the example that people with very differing opinions and very different ideologies can still have a good productive conversation and argument. And, you know, and that's what education is all about and a good political system actually is all about.
Right, right, know? Right. And so, of course, when they hear themselves, it gives them time to reflect on what mm-hmm. they're saying
yeah.
and wonder whether they're right or wrong.
Sure. You know, that's the right. I mean, I remember one, actually, when I went to work as a visiting professor at Washington and Lee University before coming here, actually,
okay.
after graduate school, I had this kind of really cool liberal boss. I won't mention his name. And, he's a really cool guy. And he kind of warned me at some point to tell me, well, you know, this is very elitist school and, you know, the vast majority of the students are, you know, conservatives.
Right.
And I kind of laughed and said, well, that's fine. And, you know, I'll make them better conservatives. And I still adhere
that's
to
good,
that.
That's good.
You know, I still adhere to that, that's my job, you know. And even if by arguing back at them and say, oh yeah, but you haven't thought about it. What do you think about this? How about that? Go look that up, you know. They might change their minds. Not responsible for that, but all I want them is to, you know, but they would also reinforce their opinions. It's just like when I present a paper at a conference, right? And people are all there, like, you know, nastily pointing out the weaknesses and the things that, oh, but did you read that paper? No. well, you obviously don't know what you're talking about. Right? So, but then I'll read it, you know, and next time I know what I'm talking about, you know? So criticism makes you stronger. So, you know, ignoring inevitable problems inherent in a system, any system, you know, socialists ignored their problem, you know, the communists, look what happened to them. Their
right.
system collapsed. And our system is closing in on collapsing right now. And we shouldn't tighten our, you know, oh, believe in our core. No, we should look, what can we do? You know, what's exactly going wrong? And if, you know, you're a liberal and you hear like the right wingers talking about the Fed and you're like, it's all like right wing conspiracy. No. Listen, you know, they got a point there. So be careful. Yeah, sure. There's right wing conspiracy out there and there's left wing conspiracy
mm-hmm.
and there might be right. Some of it, you know, but you know, by that dialogue, you might get a hint at what's conspiracy, what's foolishness, and what's actually very valid arguments. That dialogue. Of course, then another thing, I mean, kind of like that economics went through is the scientism, as it's sometimes called, you know, it's like, want it to be like physics, you know? Those guys get all the military budgets and stuff, right? I mean, you know, get to build really big machines, you know? So we want to do it too. So there was some of that going on, and therefore, you know, the rewards were given over since the World War era, since the Second World War. That's when the current version of economics came to become economics. Before it was one school of thought among many. Yeah, really. It's like World War II, which sounds like a long time ago for most people, but in terms of history of ideas, you know, and epochs, that's just recent. And often a problem of looking for, and we see that in the political sphere, looking for simple answers to complicated questions. And that's like the joke of the drunk searching for his keys, you know. You see a drunk searching for his keys under the lamp, under the street lamp, and you ask him, what are you looking for? My keys. Where'd you lose them? Over there, back in the dark alley. And then, why are you looking here? Because there's light. I mean, you can see here, but they're not here. You have to venture out into the dark alley and you don't have the light and sorry, the math models don't work and you have to read dusty books and it's complicated, but you can't avoid it. But you know, there's still some hope. I think there's some movement towards the complication. And again, here we are trying, and in my department here, we're trying to teach from multiple perspectives. You know, right wing, left wing, and different schools of thought. And the students respond very well to it. So they like it. They find it intriguing.
Yeah, and you know, I definitely have to say that it's just really too bad that there's not enough liberal colleges or universities in the country to, you know, start fostering that kind of innovative attitude, you know, the thinking process. You know, I went to the University of Puerto Rico. There was definitely nothing that actually inspired me to even think about the what ifs or, you know, let's try something else until, you know, I came to the U.S. and then I started seeing for myself, you know, okay, this is a different alternative, or why is this happening? How can it be changed? Because I was being directly affected by it. And of course, you know, coming to Rollins, a liberal arts school, then I was exposed to all these, you know, radical opinions, you know, on the conservative side, and of course the other alternatives. And, you know, I've been able to have that dialogue that most people wouldn't want me to have with them.
Yeah, that's, and sadly, you know, in some sense, first of all, it's already a relatively small, segment, right, of the education, system, of the higher education system, and it's shrinking, and there is a, I believe that there is a, there's a misconception, you know, that the practicality lies somehow in professional training. That will lead you to a job. Well, first of all, as an economist, I can't but, you know, realize that, you know, supply does not create its own demand. Certainly not in the labor market. It's one of those things, by the way, on the list of, like, things that have been long proven to be wrong. Yet somehow there's a wonderful book, by the way, called Zombie Economics. It's kind of for people who really like economics, or maybe studied some especially, or just really are interested, they could check it out. But it's precisely all these ideas that really should have been put to rest, yet somehow they come back from the grave. So one of them is the supply creates its own demand, supply side aside, and certainly in the labor market, not even a hint. So this notion that, oh, if Americans were more educated, somehow if there were more good engineers in America, we would be manufacturing again? No. there's plenty of good engineers in America. They're the best engineers in the world. Yet they are unemployed or not employed in to the best of their abilities. So there is this I'm very skeptical personally. I think that really in a world of rapid change, liberal arts is the best way to go. Now, there might be different ways of doing liberal arts, and as you know, and actually we talked, 2 weeks ago? I mean, I do experiment with this, try and make it, you know, I think that there's lots of things we could change about the liberal arts. We can make it more modular, we can make it more flexible, we can do a lot of interesting things. But this notion that you need kind of a general understanding of multiple disciplines to deal with real-world phenomenon, and from multiple ideological perspectives, then you learn to think, in a sense, right? And then you can figure things out, or maybe then take a professional program that will teach you specific skills, if that's appropriate. Like,
right.
But to understand the big picture, to be educated. I mean, I'm old school. I'm like, you know, Enlightenment, 18th century kind of era. You know, to understand what questions to ask. You know, not to learn how to do this specific, that's a kind of vocational school in a sense. And there is a movement towards that, whether it is from the, you know, the federal level all the way to the state, the new curriculum that a lot of people are arguing about, what Common Core, you know, the general push towards education that delivers. I would say that, you know, we would need to make it cheaper, you know, we're more efficient. And in fact, liberal arts, initially.
Right.
Certainly.
Right.
So that people know what, even just to find out what they're good at, before they go into any kind of professional studies.
Now, you know, this is one thing that, in conversation with my fellow students, who, you know, are well-to-do, Okay. You know, we all like the liberal arts because of the difference of opinion and all that. But one of the things that I personally think that's lacking in the liberal arts school is the real-time education. By that I mean is that if we encourage social responsibility, then yes, we should possibly have our students go into an impoverished neighborhood, you know, see what it's like to be poor, you know, paint the buildings or do whatever on the premise of social responsibility. That way they get a real sense of how everybody else lives. I mean, you know, at one point I had money, now I don't. I've been on both sides of the equation. I know what it feels to be poor, and I know what it means to have money. But a lot of students in a liberal arts college, because of the tuition the way it is,
you know,
they come from affluent families who will never be going to a neighborhood that's impoverished. You know, maybe they will join the Peace Corps. Who knows?
Yeah, it's tricky.
But, but the amount of students that are actually exposed to that, I gotta say, it's gotta be less than 5%.
Well, I mean, you know, there's a lot of, like, here again, and here there's a tremendous amount of all these service initiatives that, you know, they try. It's not easy. Because, you know, if you're a rich kid, you get on the bus, you go help the poor on the weekend. I mean, not a good, bad thing, but you really get your, in fact, sometimes they would know, the experts that do these kind of things in, Chase Hall, you know, that you're really important to debrief it, you know, to explain, because you could actually reinforce the very same, you know, the same stereotypes you're trying to disabuse them of, you know. You go, yeah, you go to poor school and you see the kids are really, you know, misbehaving. So you think, yeah, they're just, you know, they're just crazy. That's the way they are. They deserve to have a terrible life.
No, and that's mentality. Yes.
And there's, you know, you're sometimes cynical to think that, oh, you make the better world a better place by going and volunteer someplace. But then, you know, just like corporations are, you know, giving a little bit of money for charity. But then in their main activity, they do famously, like my senior student a few years back who told me about how Coca-Cola, you know, poisons the water from thousands of communities in India, you know, creating terrible birth defects, miscarriages, and but then they have some kind of institute for to empower women in which they help like a small fraction of the women they poisoned.
Right, right.
So there's some cynicism about that, that maybe, in fact, that would lead to, again, kids from you know, privileged background to feel that a little bit of charity work actually makes the world a better place, which is almost like a caricature that back, you know, it's like from pre-revolutionary France kind of thing, right?
Right, right.
No, you have to change the way it works, the way the system works, if you want to give opportunities to people and you want to really help them. You can't really do it through individual action. I mean, it's lovely to do individual action. It's great. I'm not, you know, saying anything against that, but it's not enough. So it might cause this there is an element of that. So I'm a little bit cynical in some sense. I don't know. On the one hand, I personally don't exactly see how a school could really offer you the education that'll get you a job. I really can't say that I understand exactly what is that, other than basic things, and those I try and do, you know, writing, reading, oral communication, you know, the kind of stuff that you'd be expecting to do in pretty much any job, and you know, people need practice. So that's a good thing to do in the classroom. But this notion of teaching you a profession and then that'll get you a job, I really don't quite follow that argumentation. I think it's misguided. Precisely these kind of, again, to these critical thinking skills, general education that allows you to hook knowledge onto, you know, it's like a scaffolding in your head that whatever kind of new knowledge you can, like, you pick up that book and you know, it makes sense because you've seen these patterns before, right? You read the things that the author read. You know, and you understand, you get the references, whether it be jokes, you know, or more practical things. I'm concerned sometimes with education system becoming a kind of an offshoot of the self-help industry.
Right, right.
But again, I don't want to be too negative. I mean, self-help might be, you know, a positive attitude is probably necessary for some things. You know, I know. For sure, I know. I sit down to design a brand new course, you know, instead of recycling the first one. It's like, oh, are you going to work like crazy for the next year, or are you going to just recycle? Why do you do this to yourself? You know, the temptation is there. But I have the positive attitude in some sense, you know, of wanting to do this differently.
Right. And you know, definitely major props to you, because I've had those professors who they don't change the course. I mean, when mm-hmm. you know, in a mixed group of people, and, oh, you going to see this professor and take this class? Yeah, okay. So, you know, a few months later, you say, so how was it? What is he teaching? And then you see that it's the same thing that you were taught. Nothing's been updated. Of course.
Well, sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes things are not updated. Yeah, I totally understand. But, you know, it seems to me that, yeah, like you said, it should be updated, you know, because
it's a lot of work, though, you know, and it's a bit of a, you know, and again, I do think, in fact, that's, you know, my work on gamification and using technology in certain ways is precisely in order to try and preserve what's good about, you know, independent, personalized, kind of liberal arts education. But being able to do more with less time and resources, in a sense, kind of, you know, labor enhancing technology.
Right, right.
But of course, it's hard.
I do have to say that, you know, in, you know, in on the other side, you know, and when I see you working on it, I mean, you have your hands full and all that, you know, I can relate to these other professors who keep rehashing the same topic mm-hmm. because they really don't have time.
That's exactly right. I mean, remember that one of the things that changed with American education, I mean, first of all, administration has gone up by over 400%.
Right.
If you wonder where the costs are, mm-hmm. then just say that. Some of them highly paid and not quite clear what they do. There's also a tremendous amount of small time, non-academic activities. Now, again, these are, I mean, some of my friends, you know, and I think they're good doing a lot of things and not getting anywhere near the kind of vice presidential pay. In fact, they're underpaid in many ways. But sometimes you wonder, you know, well, I mean, there's a cost there, you know, all those extra activities, absolutely there. But faculty has grown very little. And today, in higher education in America, the majority of the teaching is done by adjuncts. Many of them, a shocking amount of them, are on food stamps. They're that poor.
Yes.
So, you know, if I'm going to work and teach a course in a university, and I'm paid $2,000, I mean, we pay a little bit better, but still, you know,
mm-hmm.
$2,000 a course, I'm going to have to teach like 15 courses.
Right. I
have a hard time. I teach 3-3, and if I want to get a little bit extra money and go on vacation, I teach an extra summer semester or two and things like that. Yes. They have to teach so much. And then, you know, what are you going to do? I can simply select a textbook. It comes with its website and it's, you know, a canned exam, the course, and I can the PowerPoints, I fire them up on the board, but that is really not good education. So once again, is it about the quality of the teacher? In many cases, it isn't about the quality of the teacher. It's about the teachers who are working in ways they're not allowed to teach. They could if they were allowed to flourish. There's a reason why, for example, faculty are supposed to to get tenure, you know, full-time faculty, to do research. So we are, you know, in touch with what's going on, you know? So we don't teach stuff that has been, that's completely, you know, out of date.
That's right, right.
You know? And that we are kind of plugged into the world. It's difficult to turn this into a mass produced, you know, you can't have it be produced by child slaves in China.
true, very true.
Can't be done. I mean, though I think child slaves in China could teach political economy better than I can.
Right.
Cause they know.
Yeah, they live it.
Yeah, they live it.
But you know, I've seen it. I mean, it is a problem. I've had some amazing adjunct professors who I look up to on the psychology department who are no longer here. You know, and it's not because it's a bad school. On the contrary, it is an amazing school. But the truth of the matter is the economics push them to look mm-hmm. elsewhere or to add on.
Or to leave the business of teaching.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it's really a shame the state of affairs that we have here in the U.S. right now, education. You know, and of course, you've had all these presidents, I mean, from Clinton, the Bush, the Obama. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm going to be the educational president, well, you know what? You all failed.
Yeah. It's not an easy matter. And I do, again, go back. I almost hate to be like a member of the Libertarian Party. All my socialist friends will hate me. Nah, it's all good. That just throwing a little bit of extra money is not the deal here. We really have to review it in a sense, but be very careful. You have to be conservative about education with a small C. You know, you can't just, in fact, there's a lot of what's happening now is the reforms are just like buzzwords. And as a big advocate of technology and education, I find myself defending it all the time against people I respect by saying, no, I'm serious here. This is not just another silly buzzword like MOOCs and stuff, and, you know, which were from the start, frankly, a problem. But do we have to review this a little bit? Be very carefully, very cautiously. We do have to criticize the system. But again, be very careful with the incentives, because just to provide a mass produced product under a false guise of providing you with a service and charging you extra, I'm concerned that even well-meaning people, and I'm willing to give that to Bill Gates, you know, foundation, is actually doing damage. His initiative in education are doing a lot of damage. I disagree with what he's doing. We are aligning ourselves with a kind of a for-profit, you know, the Phoenix University model. It's kind of a drift. It's a little like, you know, Walmart started it, but now what, you think Target is any more ethic than Walmart? No.
Right.
You know, McDonald's started making like cows that aren't cows and saying that it's meat that isn't meat, you know, but now anything but ridiculously expensive grass-fed organic meat is the same thing. Even if it's a beautiful steak in the supermarket, it's the same cows that are filled with growth hormones that are killing our children, literally, yeah? Or making them obese, certainly. The same drift, you know, when you have these high, big lobbies of kind of a for-profit, they get the support, they provide a shoddy product, they charge top dollar, they put their money in marketing, and instead of the, what really is needed in the trenches of the education between the students and the teachers and the support staff or what have you, it's a big fight, you know, that not enough people, I think, are engaged in it, trying to, you know, evolve education, but maintaining the focus on the quality of education. And it's a difficult topic. What exactly is the quality? I totally understand that people going to go to school, they want it to be an advantage. And it still is, by the way, in the labor market.
Sure.
No doubt. But it's part of the cluster beep, isn't it, that we like to remind us? I mean, we need to have jobs. We need to have high-tech industry in America,
in
order to absorb those high-educated Americans, you know?
You know, and as far as an advantage, yeah, sure, it's still an advantage, but bottom line is the employers nowadays are looking at the kind of paper that I bring to the application as, oh, okay, we're going to have to pay this guy way too much money, so let's hire this other guy that doesn't have papers to do a job that perhaps they're not even qualified for.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
Yeah, cheap and shoddy is the name of the game, right? And that's a decision to be made. I mean, we have to, as a country, as an economy, you have to make that decision that we want people to have higher wages. We want them to, you know, be able to afford goods and services so that overall we have a well-functioning kind of economy. Look, I mean, people like to compare Germany, you know, they're one of the more successful large capitalist countries today. They have their problems, but you know, they've subsidized not their bankers, so they did too, but also their environmental technology companies. So
sure.
they have industry. They don't allow, you know, they sit and come to compromise about outsourcing. There's still plenty of wealth, and the rich are making out wonderfully well too, but they don't want to gut their country completely. You know, they come to a more, to a functional capitalism. So it works a little bit better in that sense. Policies that are considered in most, at least the mainstream America, is kind of socialism that will destroy America. No, that's capitalism, actually. That's,
right. And personally, I think a lot of the problem that we have is that because we've been programmed to be independent, I mean, all the way around, you know, look at other countries, Germany, as you mentioned, they're a country who has somewhat of a philosophy. They're looking after their country versus we're taught to be independent, to look after your own self.
Yeah, it's definitely it's a side effect, and it goes into the culture, into individual, even like psychology, and certainly in economics. Actually, it's one of the things that, I mean, in the economics education, it's a perfect place. Ooh, it's on the top of the hour, but yeah, it's a mistake, because actually, you know, America succeeded in its history through communal action, to mm-hmm. groups, to caring right. for each other. It's a terrible myth, and economists do perpetrate it a lot. This notion of it's all about yourself. You depend on yourself. You're for better or for worse. No, it's just not the case. Just like the earth isn't flat.
Well, a lot of people believe that, though.
God almighty.
Anyway, folks, we've gotten here to the top of the hour.
Indeed.
The end of Punkonomics. We hope you enjoy the show. I know we've been laughing a lot, but it's because we just don't want to cry on the air. So anyway, tune in again to Punkonomics, whether it's on punkonomics.org or Facebook. You know, the tune in radio.
And don't forget.
And don't forget.
Rick Scott, baby!
Yep, enjoy the torture.
The preceding program did not reflect the views or opinions of the station, its management, or employees.
This is Ralph Nader. You should listen to WPRK. It's the voice of the students. It'll give you a bigger framework.
WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. I am John Lydon here of Public Image Limited. You may also know me as Rotten, and I may know you as W.